Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness and spiritual practice can play key roles in helping human beings rise to the challenges of a unique moment of crisis and to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. I've been holding a series of profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders, over 50 of them at this point. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This evening, I'm honored and delighted to be joined by Dr. Jean Houston for a special broadcast event where we're going to continue that discussion in a conversation we've titled Everyday Life as a Heroic Journey. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Jean and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and so we'll finish up after about 90 minutes. Dr. Jean Houston is a scholar, a philosopher, and a researcher in higher human capacities, one of the most foremost visionary women of our time, a truly towering figure in the transformation of human culture for almost 50 years, one of the principal founders of the human potential movement. A powerful and dynamic speaker, she holds conferences and seminars with social leaders, educational institutions, and business organizations worldwide. She's worked intensively in over 40 cultures and 100 countries, helping diverse peoples enhance and deepen their own uniqueness while they become part of a global community. Jean Houston has since her childhood connected or worked closely with some of the leading figures of our time, including Helen Keller, Teilhard de Chardin, Margaret Mead, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, and Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, and Bill, and especially Hillary Clinton. In 1965, along with her husband, Dr. Robert Masters, she founded the Foundation for Mind Research, and they co-authored the book, Mind Games, celebrated by John Lennon's famous song by that same name. She's worked extensively as an advisor to several UN agencies. She's a past president of the Association for Humanistic Psychology, and she's also the founder and principal teacher since 1982 of her Mystery School, a school of human development dedicated to teaching history, philosophy, the new physics, psychology, anthropology, myth, and the many dimensions of human potential. She's also pioneered what she calls social artistry and conducts trainings in her school for social artistry as well. She's a prolific writer, author of 26 books, including A Passion for the Possible Human, and Jump Time. It's a real delight to welcome you, Jean, as my guest tonight. Hi.
Hello there, Terry. Thank you. I listened to this biography, and I wonder, as I look at the dogs who are waiting for their dinner, who are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about you, Jean, and I think maybe to begin, because you have, you know, such an encyclopedic knowledge of such a rich array of things, and we've decided to focus our conversation tonight on this matter of everyday life as a heroic journey. Mm-hmm. When we had our conversation and we kind of zeroed in on this topic, there was something about that that was inspiring you and feeling particularly alive and relevant right at this moment in time. I'd like to give you a chance to begin by talking about that.
Well, you know, Terry, I think in this last year we have seen a refreshment of people power. You know, what with the fact that the same old is not working anymore. They were living in the time of perhaps the greatest deconstruction of all the old ways of being, and with it a formidable reconstruction that is rising from the depths, and I'm talking about things like the obviously the Occupy movement, something that I've had a lot to do with, as well as all of these formidable volunteer organizations that are rising up to saying, look, it's not happening from top down, we'd better start to get to work. Because it's as if a kind of spirit has ignited literally all over the world. And as you say, you know, I've worked in, 107 countries at this point, and I'm seeing it literally everywhere it's happening. So that, you know, on the front pages of our newspapers and in our, you know, our news broadcasts, we get news of murder and mayhem and breakdown. But then you get beneath the stories and you find out, you know, as I've been privileged to have front row seat on, that formidable new things are rising to face these challenges, virtually heroic things, you see. And I think that's one of the reasons why I decided that, or I thought in our discussion, that we should explore what does the hero or an heroine's journey, and they are rather different, what does it really mean for our time? Practically, what can we do to be part of it?
Well, that's great. You know, one of the things that I have encountered in my students who are inspired by a call very similar to the one you've just articulated is that some of them immediately recognize themselves as being called to really try to play a bigger role in the process of cultural transformation and mm-hmm. do things that on the outside look very much like leadership or heroism, mm-hmm. whereas others do not. And sometimes it's a bit more of a leap for them to see the heroic dimensions of a life that doesn't have as obviously prominent or, you know, a role that looks outwardly heroic or prominent.
Sure.
And I think that when you talk about this, you're talking about something that has many dimensions, one of them which is quite profound and esoteric. And I wanted to give you a chance perhaps to begin by talking about what is at the essence of the heroes and heroines' journeys at a deep psychic level, and then how that manifests in all our lives and in our life collectively.
Well, as you know, I was a good friend of Joseph Campbell, who wrote the great book on the hero's journey. And when he died, and I gave one of the main speeches at his memorial, that night I fought the bed. I had a dream. It wouldn't go away. I keep waking up. I get back in the dream. And the dream was Joe. And Joe saying to me, Gene, come to Riverside Drive and help me with the correspondence. And while I continued to make very, what I thought were legitimate excuses to send Joe people with secretarial skills to help them, he said, no, no, no. And finally, you know, in desperation, around 7 in the morning, I said, okay, I'll come. And he said, now we can really get to work. So I woke up with these sore and strained muscles. And in the days that followed, I continued to be haunted by the dream. I knew I hadn't got it. Why is he asking me to help with his correspondence? Well, some weeks later, I told the dream to a friend whose wisdom and experience I value. He said, why, Gene, it's so simple. He meant the correspondences. You're supposed to help find the correspondences between myth and everything else, history, science, psychology, and what's trying to happen in the world, the pathway from the past, the pathways to the future. And my response, Terry, was the classic shock of recognition. Oh, of course, that's it. That's it. And you know, Joe and I, you know, had this long history, and we really did explore many of the correspondences by which myth sheds its radiant light on the multiplicity of human learnings as well as the mysteries of the human heart. But so much more seemed to be left to be done. And then, of course, remembering my reading of his great book when I was very young, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which gave me the subject for, you know, many, many of the kinds of correspondences that particularly speak to our time. Now, what Joe had done in that book about the hero is he looked at 240 examples from all over the world, and he found that there were very great similarities. And one of the things, and this is so important for our discussion, Terry, was that Heroes and heroines seem to always emerge in a time of dying. The dying of the self, the dying of social sanctions, the dying of society's usual forms, the dying of standard brand religions, the dying of governments and economics and psychologies and relationships, you know, such as we're seeing today. And in answering the call of the eternal, which seems to be evolution sprouting up and saying, now it's time to get on with it, people discover the courage to perform the first great task of the hero or heroine, which is to something that I'm seeing happening all over the world, to undergo all the gestations and the growth and the trauma that seems to be required for new birth, because unless we have new birth into our possible humanity, we're not going to have a possible society. And so people begin to undergo these tremendous inward and outward journeys so that they can serve as evocateurs, midwives of the larger society, so that they can bring a higher level of functioning into time. Now, what we would think of as the dearth of heroes in our time, or worse, I mean, the media's treatment of them as banal, this has created a dangerous trend, because we have lost the high and holy service of those who could bring us and our world the much-needed new birth, the next step in what I believe, is the creation of a global society. That's where I think we're headed during the next 50 years, the creation of a global society with high individuation of culture. And I think that's why the classical heroic tradition seems to be in abeyance, and yet its great patterns have become part of our lives as everyday heroes. And so it's being remythologized. The idea of the hero, it's being remythologized, reborn in the light of the Earth's spirit, which is calling us to a new humanity. And I think this new form of heroism, one that takes into account one of the most important things that's happened in the last 5,000 years, which is the rise of women. I mean, with terrible backlash, but the rise of women to full partnership with men in the whole domain of human affairs, along with it, the impossibility of war, the complexity of current social forms, the ecological breakdown, the fact that the world mind is taking a walk with itself with our telecommunications and the internet, and the need for what we can only refer to as a global sensibility. So, you know, you talked about call. Joe Campbell's journey begins with something that's true for both men and women. Everybody is called. We're called into life. We're called into learning. We're called into loving. We're called into doing. We're called into helping. We're called into reconciling. We're called into journeying. We're called by the outward. We're called by the inward. We're called by the flesh, God knows. We're called by the spirit. We're called into creating. We are called beyond our limits. We're called into transcendence. And finally, we're called into death. So calling and being called seems essential to our vocation as human beings. It's part of our, what should we say, Terry? It's part of our instinct for evolution. And so I find with all the research, the hundreds and thousands of research subjects that I've had and the several million seminar participants, that the lure of becoming sounds in the back of our minds, and it sounds in the beat of our heart, it's in the flow of our blood all the time. So is it any wonder that so often we seek the call, we yearn for a clarity that often eludes us? What is my purpose in being? What special task am I here to do? How do I respond to this lure of becoming and keep up sufficient energy and passion and momentum and delight and engagement and fascination so that I agree to be lured? I agree to be constantly lured. And unfortunately, you know, the stuff of everyday life often inhibits the lure. You say, not now, God, later, maybe, well, I don't know, when I grow up, when I lose weight, when I pay my taxes, maybe when the kids grow up, you know. Or we fall into the sodden comforts of habit, or into the alienations of discomfort, or what is even worse, we demand that the call be given to us in our own particular terms and in very specific ways. You know, now God, if you don't show up as something that I can actually photograph, or at least as a burning bush, I'm not doing anything for you. And I
well,
think
the, yes, this there are so many points of resistance, and as I'm hearing you say this, I'm remembering some things about the hero's journey that that are striking me. That the core, as I remember it, is that the hero is a king or a queen, a royal being, but who is living in an identity smaller than his true identity, has not been recognized, and actually needs to go through a process to recover that identity. And almost universally, the hero's journey begins with the refusal of the call. That it's, we're right on schedule if we've refused the call.
Yes, that's right.
That in fact, it's only after kind of fate knocks twice and says, if you didn't hear me the first time, maybe you'll hear me now, that something breaks through. And hearing that, I'm struck by, you know, this idea that Dogen talks about of the Genjo koan, the
yes.
koans that we are given by life, that are not the artifices of the Zen master, but are just given to us, all of us together here on this planet, seem to me to have been given a tremendously demanding koan. How do we make a healthy adaptive response to this critical inflection point in our evolutionary journey? And I think each of us is knowing that we have a unique way of embodying that, and yet all of us together are knowing that together we have to find ways to come together, each in our uniqueness, as a new kind of culture. And you know, I know you're very sensitive to these ideas, but how that then gets expressed in our everyday lives, I feel like that's such a rich vein for us to explore.
Very much so. Well, I think one of the ways is to realize that very often the call doesn't come as a cosmic greeting. Yoo-hoo, you know. But sometimes it comes, and this really gets down and dirty here, it becomes as a big mistake, as a blunder, that may turn out to be the call to the deeper life. I mean, often our big mistakes lead us into experiences we never thought to have. And I find that the blunder has a very large role to play in virtually all journeys of transformation, I mean, heroic or otherwise. And it often marks the transition from one way of life to another. I mean, one of its subtleties is that it may not seem significant when it begins, or perhaps it was inevitable. You know, when we really delve into our own lives for blunders, we find sometimes they come out of patterns of behavior that have been so deeply planted in our existence through culture, through conditioning, family, profession. Why did you marry that man or woman? Why did you go to that church? Why did you take on that particular profession? You know, that we become its unwitting victims. And for those of us who have been launched on a journey of transformation, I mean, this pattern of behavior may mean a fall into a, what should we call it, a disordered and disordering reality that plunges us into the mystery of the night journey of our own souls. Because, and sometimes it's only after major mistakes caused by these troubling traits or conditioning that we move beyond our complacency and enter into what I call the pathos of soul-making. So that these signs, these mistakes, these blunders can become the evolutionary stimuli to the growth of one's humanity. I mean, maybe this is where Charles Darwin is wrong when he says that it's the ability to adapt that signals the mark of an evolving being. I'm going to suggest that maybe for the human species at least, it's the inability to adapt. It is the impetus to make interesting errors, to pull one bummer after the other, that finally pushes us to the point of such excruciating pain or frustration that we're forced to start to make new choices, to find the will and the courage to carry them through. I mean, I'm looking at my dogs here, and a bunch of cats just walked in too. I have a lot of animals. And I see clearly that in many ways they learn much more quickly than we do, and they don't continue to commit the same blunders. Oh, why did I make those choices? Was it for reasons of pride or ego or the expectation of family or society? So however we came to choose to continue in the old ways and not hearken to the potential for change around us. It is, I think, the way of the reciprocal universe that the deeper order of things sees us and chooses us as candidates for initiation, blows us off our courses to the very edges of our known world. I mean, and often it's the recurrence of a chronic trait. For example, mine is to say, yes, come work with us, Jean. Come work with an order of nuns halfway around the world for a month and with no salary. Yes, okay. Could you please take this big dog in, even though you already have several other dogs? Yes, I will. Would you please write a preface for my book and for mine and for mine and for mine? Yes, yes, yes. Would you please come and give a workshop in Africa, followed by training executives in Hong Kong, followed immediately by working with villagers in South America? Yes, I'll come. So I see what this does is it portrays a life that has been deepened because of calls taken and blunders made. So I'm looking right now at the call as a remythologizing of the blunder, a remythologizing it as the way life...
A deeper understanding that the mistake, however, there's usually something lost in a mistake, so there may be something to grieve, but that it is actually creating an opportunity for something that is a gift and seeing that gift rather than dwelling on what's lost.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And then you talked about, the refusal of the call, which is a major station. I mean, putting the summons off or delaying it because it always comes at an inconvenient time, or because one doesn't feel oneself worthy, or you're caught up in the demands of everyday life. I can't tell you how. I go through the supermarket, and I see this woman, with two kids, and everybody's yelling, and she's looking longingly at the little book, the little paperback bookstore, and when I start to talk to her, and she says, I had a degree in political science, and I yearn so much to be able to start thinking again, and I know what I know could be important, but I'm burdened with this. What can I do? Where could I find the time? I can't find the time, and that's something else. So I actually stop her, and we have a half-hour session in the middle of the supermarket as I show her ways of finding and really deepening into sacred time. I mean, there gets a point where your yearning is so intense that you cannot say no, and you reluctantly say yes, and then it really begins.
Yeah.
Because what happens next in everyday life is the allies show up. Synchronicities begin to happen. The universe starts to get very interested in you. You can no longer continue to live a life of serial monotony or just the too muchness, because you need to get into suchness. And that's when, the book comes, the friend sends you the book, you turn on the right television station, an opportunity comes your way. What my friend Deepak Chopra refers to as synchro destiny begins to operate. Or you begin to say, look, I've got to go within. You start to listen to your kind of course, Terry. You start looking. You go beyond the awakening up to do the darn thing that you have to do. You begin the spiritual process or the prayer spiritual practice. In my work, you begin to turn on a lot more factors, more creative aspects, and you say, all right, and those are the allies, the inner allies and the outer allies, aren't they? Haven't you found that so in your own life?
I very much have, and yet I do, just like in the hero's journey, the classic hero's journey, the hero sets off on the journey and then encounters these apparent obstacles. And in the process of finding one's way through obstacle after obstacle, actually, in some of the myths it goes on and on, we often discover that the one who seemed to be blocking our path is our ally.
Yes,
we often find ourselves discovering that the pictures that we have as to what is our ally and what isn't our ally just get thrown open. And what that brings about for me is a profound trust and a kind of quality of curious expectancy that arrives back in everyday life, in every moment, in which that subtle shift of mood, in which the world that has begun to seem a bit drained of color and quotidian and serial monotony, as you put it, the jaded or taking for granted kind of stance that we slip into in our lives, gets interrupted. And I begin to discover that it was a lie all along, and that the what at first might have seemed like cultivating an attitude of expectancy or curiosity or openness stops being about inventing something, but dropping something that's in the way of what's always already here under the surface anyway. And when I wake up to that, then I'm alive in real life, which it actually isn't a device or a novel way of framing things. Maybe you can discover a way of relating to life that makes it a hero's journey. No, getting out of the way, you discover it all already is.
It already is, yes. So what you really have just discussed is that next stage of the hero's journey, which is trying to cross into the threshold of the amplified life, amplified power. You are stopped by the guardian of the threshold. As you've just said, I mean, often a monster, typically unfriendly. The guardian is given to what? Schedules, fixed habits, I mean, attitudes cast in concrete. And this is the worthy adversary. I mean, the guardian can show up in supervisors and bosses and in friends who are given to primitive reptilian behavior, generally overprotective of the status quo. At worst, this guardian devours us or turns us into wimpy versions of itself. I mean, a sort of assistant dinosaur.
Mm.
But as you say, at best, it turns out to be an ally because it hones our pluck and cunning and requires that we fool it with witty ways to get past its snatching arms. And
just
so
like
that
really hard English teacher who made you read more and think harder, or that very tough math teacher that you hated all year long and then end up being eternally grateful to.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the truth, I never got past her. First year of high school. But anyway, I think that we find ways to get past them, and we grow in the process, lest we become, as I say, these assistant dinosaurs, keeping others from their quests and possibilities. But once across in this series, the hero is swallowed by the unknown, be it a whale, you know, Jonah and the whale, or a wolf, or a sarcophagus, or a cave. And this stage, which is known as the belly of the whale, permits us to dissolve our identity in order to be rewoven into a stronger and brighter form. And it is the place of strengthening. It is a kind of second womb in which we're gestated into our higher selves. We enter into a state of regenesis, into what I would call the process of second birth. I mean, we die to our modernity, and we're reborn to our eternity. And of course, we know the belly of the whale in many guises. It can take the form of a depression, or an ingression, or even a strong way to, you know, a terrible need to get away from it all. And so we go into seminars, or into meditations, or we take on spiritual practices so different from the ones we grew up with. I think that, in part, the present divine delicatessen, you know, the divine deli where everybody, we have Sufi Jews who tap dance. I mean, the very fact that we are looking at the harvest of the world's spiritual traditions, and we find, as you have so brilliantly done, Terry, integral ways of practice. But I also want to say it can take the form of depression, not the clinical depression, but a depression in which really you are being called inward and deeper. Only the society calls it depression, but it's really the call to the inner life, where you then, if you take on the practices, you begin to grow, what should I say, the evolutionary patterns, the latencies of our higher becoming. And then, in the story of the hero's journey, you're allowed into the realm of amplified power, sometimes called the road of trials or the road of adventures, which I prefer. And, of course, in the hero, classical hero-heroine's journey, this is a time of incredible tests, extraordinary adventures. It's where the hero moves in a fantastical dream landscape of curiously fluid and ambiguous forms that he or she has to survive as a succession of trials. And of course, that this is the part in when you read the great legends and myths, it's always the favorite of the storytellers, of the epic poets, of the novelists, because it is here that they can give full vent to the dread we all fear before the unknown and the unbound. You know, be it in the desert or the wilderness or the sea, or in the corresponding places in the labyrinth of our own unconscious life. So you're hurled into adventures and challenges for which you have little preparation, and yet somehow you find the resources to survive. Don't you think so?
Well, it's interesting the way my way of relating to the hero's journey is to notice how profound and universal it is and how it shows up in my own experience.
Yes.
In little ways that might be contained even in a short series of moments across an hour or two, or over across a day or two or three, or across a month, or across a year, and then of course my whole life is described by it. And when I appreciate that, and I notice the little ways that I am called, that I cross a threshold, that I encounter tests and adventures and allies, and I'm given totems, and I have to make that dread journey to the underworld and battle my nemesis and nearly die in the process, but in that process recover my true identity and come back to my true home and claim my dominion and set right what was wrong in the kingdom and begin to be a benefactor to my people. You know, that all of that is, those archetypes are so powerful. They structure almost every good story that we've ever been gripped by, but they are enacted, actually enacted in our lives. So for me, I think the thing that I most, as I contemplated us having this conversation, the thing that I most wanted to explore was to help anyone on this line who is tending, you know, I think the really heroic thing is in the place where we're beginning to lose heart and to lose faith.
Yes, yes.
And where we have to see through the lie of our own jaded, dead eyes that can't see the brightness, the light, that see the brokenness and aren't yet recognizing that those cracks are where the light gets in, and to then rivet in on some of these apparently lonely and difficult and even disheartening moments of life and appreciate them or open to them. Maybe, you know, it isn't so much a matter of laying this narrative onto our experience as to relax and open to our experience so deeply that we let it reveal its own nature, and then freely entering into it, we discover, oh my goodness, this classic archetypal story is playing itself out, even in this aspect of my life that I couldn't love.
And I think that's why at this stage in the journey, the supernatural allies show up. As you're suggesting, the greater mysteries of the nature of reality begin to be unfold, because we may be at rock bottom in our souls, but there the universe opens up. We step into the abyss, and yet somehow the ground firms up under our feet. These then become the initiations to a re-patterned, reconditioned, restructured life. The greater mysteries of reality. I think of the whole genre of the Native American shamans, you know, such as those that we meet in Carlos Castaneda's books about Don Juan, teach us that the initiator can be one who laughs at and who taunts us while putting us through our paces. I mean, we all remember painfully, as you just said, I mean, the teacher who humbled us, or if you will, the friend who jeered, the relative who found us ridiculous. And thus our initiator is sometimes a humiliator, one who turns us into humus, you know, making certain that we are earthy and grounded before we learn to soar.
Yeah.
But it can also be a spiritual beloved, and I'm speaking of this in its metaphysical sense, who you agree to partner, we are willing to take on the strange relationships, the deeper ideas, you know, the beloved, the way that Rumi took on Shams al-Tabriz, you know. But I think it's also true that one of the things that we find in these states, that what we consider to be our worst quality, turns out at depth to be our highest quality. For example, I'll use myself as exemplum paribum. If I were to look at my worst quality, there's no question it's hypersensitivity. I was my mother's 7-month baby. I was totally unfinished. and what happens with some of us who are 7 month babies is that we don't have the sheathing, that protective sheathing. So if you drop a pin, I can literally feel it go, whoop, you know, through my system. Mm-hmm. And yet I live a very, very public life. For me to have my ideal life, I would live in a cave, I'd raise Airedales, I would translate ancient Greek poetry, and I would play Bach on the harpsichord. That's my idea of an ideal life, instead of this life that takes us, to me, over 100,000 miles a year all over the world working with people at sometimes some of the most critical levels, you know, holding dying AIDS people in my arms and you know, having been shot at and diving into trenches and then having to deal with the egos of heads of state. And, you know, I have a life that is not appropriate for my system. And, of course, you catch a lot of hell, too, because you're out there, you know, trying to innovate and create and challenge. Anyway, so what do I do? That's my worst quality. I'm hypersensitive. I used to greatly admire Margaret Mead, who every time she needed more energy, what she did is she went to a drawer where she kept all her hate mail. And so she said, oh boy, I'm tired. I better read my hate mail. So she'd pull out the drawer, and she'd get a hate letter from 10 years before, and she'd read it, and she'd go, rah! And she'd be filled with energy. I can't do that when I wish I could. I don't keep my hate mail. But anyway, what we find that if I go deeper and I find what is my high quality, it is radical empathy. That's my best quality, which lies beneath. And this radical empathy, you know, I frankly have very leaky margins. It gives me, you know, empathy for people and for cultures and for ideas, and allows me to be a kind of high sensitive in the world, to be able to see what is trying to happen, what is trying to emerge, what are the qualities in another person that I can help to evoke, you see. And so if I were to ask you, you don't have to do this, but I'm saying if I were to ask you what is your worst quality, I'll tell you what I think, and this is not psychological, it's purely mythic knowing, what I think your highest quality is. I go deeper, you see.
That's rich. Well, I think you know, it's funny. I actually have a hard time with questions like worst and best, because it kind of
implies... Well, the one that you really don't like, you know.
Yes. Well, I think that I often feel limited by a softness in myself that doesn't allow me to gracefully rest in the power and authority that I have, and instead strives to assert it where that assertion is utterly less effective and powerful than resting in it. I think that there's a trust of being that I've been deepening in my whole life. But, you know, when I was really raw and young, I kept thinking I had to try. And I keep learning that lesson on deeper levels.
So it is the responding to what you're calling the softness or the tenderness with an assertive disposition from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if I were to listen at a deeper level, what it is about is the genius of balance and of the yin-yang, obviously, and of the qualities that are those of tenderness and compassion and the qualities of creation and manifestation in the world. So that your genius, your deep genius, is the yearning and the seeking and the training in balance. Wouldn't you say that's true?
I do recognize something like that. Thank you, Jean. I do discover that often what feels most authentic and real comes through my opening to others, and it's something that the pastoral function. When I find that the most powerful acts that I engage these days are ones that are powered by my taking a stand for human beings or for the health of our system or something. When I am completely beside the point and what's powering me is simply my sympathetic identification with the need of other hearts or of the world itself. And the place, it's almost like there's a circuitry. Isn't there a deep circuitry in the human psyche wherein power flows and effectiveness flows when that circuitry links up? And each of us has to find our own place where that circuitry is really alive for us. I think I've found it most when I feel in service of something larger than myself. I feel in service of other beings. And then the circuitry is there, and something, and somehow the energy flows. That's what comes up for me as I contemplate what you've probed into here.
And, of course, that brings us, doesn't it, to the next stage of the journey, in which the hero and heroine are brought to the deepest point of the cycle, the nadir of the mythological world, there to be recognized by the Father Creator, which to me means to understand the nature of reality, or to have some deep wisdom about it, to see the pattern that connects, to understand the aesthetics of existence. And then, of course, in the second part, to achieve sacred marriage with the goddess, or the inner beloved of the soul. And then you enter upon apotheosis, or transformation. Now, this meeting with the beloved, I think, is very important. We see that Rumi, whose poems are really about the meeting of the beloved, is the thing, and even though he lives in the 13th century, his poems are, he is the most celebrated and bought, people buy his book, poet of our time. It's not other people that you could name. It's not Maya Angelou, find it in the order of poetry, but it is Rumi.
Yeah.
Because there is a rising tide of spiritual eros in our time, which I think has to do with the radical necessity to enter into deep creative communion with a higher spiritual force that is then felt palpably and deeply and intimately with what we are calling the beloved of the soul. I even wrote a whole book about that years ago called The Search for the Beloved, but you really find it everywhere. And it is, I think it is part of this spiritual eros, as part of the rising tide of this higher order of communion and communication that is really moving throughout the world today. You know, one of the stories I tell is that I once asked Mother Teresa, who I knew fairly well, and I said, Mother, how can you do all the odd things how can you do things that Red Cross can't do? I mean, you take care of any little child who's left outside, you know, the creche in the convent, and you take them in and you give them a good education and you love them and you support them, and then I see you, you know, I saw a leopard come toward you, and he said, Mother, I don't want to be just a leopard. I want to have something useful to do. And you help him find his way and his skills in the world. And then I see you pick up people on the street and take them home and get them well if they're dying. You give them a decent and do funeral. You know, you do all these things. How is it that you can do all this? And she said, My dear, it's because I'm so deeply in love. I said, You're in love, Mother, really? Oh, yes. Would you mind telling me who you're in love with? Not at all. I'm in love with Jesus. I'm married to Jesus. I said, Of course you are. All nuns are. She said, No, you don't understand, Jean. I really am. And I'm in such a state of loving with my beloved that I see my beloved in the poor, especially. I see my beloved in the day-old child. I see my beloved in the leper. and the people dying in the street. And I cannot do enough for my beloved. And perhaps that's because my beloved cannot do enough for me. And one of the things that we find with her, with Mother Teresa, for example, that she was able to do extraordinary things because she was a good deal of her life in this state of deep, loving relationship, although there were long periods in her life when she was in a spiritual wasteland. And yet we know that she picked herself up and acted towards others the way she wished that the beloved would act toward her. And a very similar state could be said about, actually, when I talked to the Dalai Lama about what kept him going, you see. He had a relationship with his spiritual beloved.
It is really that, isn't it? It's recognizing and feeling that immanent, transcendent being as our deepest beloved and deepest identity at the same time, paradoxically, and feeling, therefore, called beyond.
I mean, the Navajos say that if you take one step toward the God takes 10 steps toward you, and you begin to feel something or someone moving toward you, and with it sometimes a sweep of emotion that is immense, a sweetness that dissolves for an instant all barriers. I mean, a remembrance of what or whom you are a part of.
Yes. And in those, one of the things I wanted to kind of ask you about is that there are all these crucial little moments in people's day-to-day lives in which this reality of the heroic journey, that being, you know, it's very hard to be a person. It's very hard to go through this process of life. And especially once you've begun to get hip to the fact that it's a school, something else deepens, and mm-hmm. and as we're moving through this school of life in this day-to-day process, there are these choice points every day, lots of little ones all day long, and in recognizing them, we live with intention and consciousness to a greater or lesser degree. And this is, I think, the nitty-gritty of how our lives can be lived as heroic journeys more deeply, more richly, more consciously than they might otherwise be. And there are moments in that process that kind of serve as portals through which a certain level of recognition or a certain willingness or a certain aliveness allows that reality to make itself known and allows us to step into a different octave of aliveness and creativity and service. And I imagine that that can be identified in very particular moments, moments when you feel a certain way or when there's a dawning realization. And I wondered if there were specific moments in the day-to-day living that you might want to point to that are these opportunities to really step into the heroic journey that we're already living.
Well, I think a lot of it is going off of robot or same old, same old. And becoming radically present. I was just sitting next to me for many, many hours was Eckhart Tolle, you know, at this gathering we did in Beverly Hills to try to help the Hollywood community to write better dramas, you know, more life-enhancing dramas.
Mm.
And he also spoke about this, you know, and about but he talks the power of now and how you really go off of your mind being in the past, your mind being in the future, or, as I put it, the real estate of your mind being taken up by some object or person or same old, same old, the same event. I often say that if 90% of what you thought today was what 90% of what you thought yesterday and then 90% what you're going to think tomorrow, you may want to look at your life. Because if this is God's school, as you've just suggested, if this is the school where we learn to make the difficult choices and to say yes to choice and say, yes, I will be present, and we'll look at, my goodness, look at that behavior, so that you could have a fair witness in your mind that's saying, well, look at the end of, at the end of the day, look at what I just did over there. Now, that perhaps was unskilled behavior. And yet later, when I went back and I was kind and really present for that person, noticed how it changed. So it's that, that marvelous fair observer, the fair witness in your life that goes back and makes, decides to make a different choice, you see.
Mm.
And this is also where, in the next stage of the hero's journey, it's called the gaining of the boon, for which one is questing, you know, often the elixir of life, the fire of immortality, the key to knowledge, some big-time reward. And that's where my friend Campbell said that it was, it's an expansion of consciousness and therewith of being. And it brings you to the state of making a difference in the world. But that expansion of consciousness doesn't have to be a big shout from God. It is, it is, as you say, it can be in the little things. You eat your cereal in the morning and you realize where it was grown and who harvested it and the people who worked with it, and then its travel and the way it finally got to you. Or you become aware when you're taking your shower of the cleansing of all the old stuff in your life that no longer has to be there. You become aware of how everything is filled with pattern, with history, with ongoingness, with the opportunity to let go and to be made anew almost every second. And that perhaps is one of the greatest boons of all, that we are continuously in the womb of re-becoming and of our journey into the possibility of new life. But that does require a life of conscious mindfulness. So my boon, in my particular elixir, for example, is the commitment to bringing expansions of consciousness to whoever I can and wherever I'm able. But everybody's boon is going to be different. What is your great gift? What is the boon that has come out of the complexity of your own journey, your own everyday heroic journey?
And that's really what one of the things that your work specializes in, really, is helping people link that up and discover their life purpose, their destiny, their true path, and maybe to discern the hero's journey that's already been unfolding.
Well, it's also to bring clarity to the awakening by helping people cook on more burners. I mean, simply to use much more of their mind and body and psyche and the different extraordinary systems that have been crafted into our everyday, to the body mind that we bring to bear. We are truly, we are formulated to be God seeds in a world in which we are given a sufficiency of experience and opportunity to do and to be so much more than we ever really could in human history. I mean, I often say that the average human being, in most cases, lives anywhere between 4 to 10 to even 100 times the amount of sheer experience and certainly of opportunity than our ancestors of 150 years ago lived. Now, this really does throw us into the heroic journey with challenges for which we've not been prepared. It's always true that when in the great journey we are thrown into situations for which, in at least in the course of the myth, both the ancient myth and our present, for which we come unprepared and also with inadequate treatment or equipment.
Yes.
And part of our journey is to really discover that we do have the equipment. Or if not, we find friends or teammates or, you know, associates or readings or whatever, or seminars like yours that help us to rediscover that we do, in fact, have this equipment. And that's what that journey is about, I do believe. And that's why a very important part of it is what is called the magic flight back, you know, that you go back across the threshold with your boon, what you've gained intact, so that with it you can also help restore your world. And that's why, classically, you become the master or the maestro or the maestra of two worlds, able to bring the greening power of the depth world into the graying world of ordinary space and time. And I have learned from my own journeys, and I'm sure as you have too, Terry, that once you agree to the journey, once you answer the call to a larger life, there's generally no turning back. Indeed, I mean, to the listeners now, each of you might usefully consider where you find yourself right now on the cycle of your own particular everyday journey. I mean, have you heard a call to a larger life? Have you refused it? And if so, why? Have you accepted the call but then met with monsters of recalcitrance who refuse to let you pass across the threshold to your own deeper capacities and possible life? Did you finally outwit these dragons at the threshold? Did you get across? Are you caught in the belly of the whale through despair, depression, or just plain sloth? Have unusual allies or helpers shown up? You know, as I said, a telephone call at the right time, a book falling open in an important passage, or right now. Do you find yourself in the midst of a road of trials? And if so, do you discover it full of adventures or just one darned crisis after another? Is there a transformational friendship awaiting you? Do you feel the yearning for the inner beloved of the soul? Are you seeking attunement with your father or mother or relatives or friends for what they may or may not have done to you? Do you feel attunement for a world in a state of radical transition in which it sometimes seems that we just don't have the appropriate people to lead, to evoke, and you're being called upon to do something about it? Are you finding a boon, an insight, a project that might bring some healthy solution to your own and to the world's problems? Have you crossed the magic threshold and come back into ordinary life with a sense of accomplishment? Are you planning to rest for a while? Or are you raring to start the journey all over again? Or perhaps you find yourself, like the rest of us, in several different stages of the journey, you know, at the same time. I mean, these are the holy things that tell us that we are part of the God life incarnate. I mean, co-creators and stewards, stewards of creation.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jean, you sing this, it's a bright, strong call. You're a remarkable voice for this, the eternal call that has called everyone who's ever been called and who is calling each of us in some way. But I think you're, having stood so clearly and powerfully and with so much humor and gusto and just hearty, juicy, intelligent engagement for so long with so many of the people who've really helped evolve the path over the last 50 years, there's something particularly resonant about the way you sing that song. I just really want to take an admiration break and just remark on how rich that is. You know, we're here at just about an hour into this, and perhaps this is the moment when I ought to give others a chance to ask a few questions. I know we can go on forever, but I do have a few important announcements that I should make. Meanwhile, everyone who's listening, if you have a question for Jean or me, you can type that into the instant teleseminar window on your computer, if that's how you're listening. And if you've phoned in, just press *2 on your keypad, and that will raise your hand. I'm sure many of you on the call are feeling this drive toward living the kind of life that Jean and I are discussing tonight, what we're calling a heroic life, or what Jean sometimes calls a mythic life, a life that's suffused with purpose and meaning, and where you're able to make the best contribution that you can to this world at a time when it needs it the most. Well, you're not alone. And Jean has been teaching and training people for years on how to really activate their latent potentials to live this kind of a life. And that's why she designed a 7-week course, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, to take people through just this kind of training and to activate and enliven your multiple intelligences and unique gifts, to open yourself to your unique role in the world and to align what she calls our local or small selves with our higher purpose and destiny, really recognizing it. So this course, the Awakening to Your Life's Purpose course, you can learn more about by going to awakenyourpurposecourse.com. That's awakenyourpurposecourse.com. It's a distillation of Jean's decades of teaching. It's designed to facilitate this process for anyone at any stage of awakening to your purpose. Jean will help you increase your creativity, discover deep sources of emotional, spiritual, and even physical healing, access your multiple intelligences and ways of knowing, open yourself to wisdom, empathy, and patience, and discover how to tap into these deep sources of the sacred in every moment of your life. So if you're interested in working and hearing more from Jean, please head to awakenyourpurposecourse.com. Also, if you're interested in my work, I will be offering a weekend seminar, Encountering the Beloved, in New York City, March 3rd and 4th, and a 5-day deep experiential seminar at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia, Canada, June 10th through 15th. You can find out more details by going to integralspiritualpractice.com. It's also reachable just by typing in my name, terrypatton.com. Now, please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's coming up in with the weeks ahead. There's a lot to tell you about, and two I want to mention right now. This coming Sunday, I'll be speaking on the topic, Only Higher Consciousness Can Transform Our World, with physicist and spiritual activist and former presidential candidate John Hagelin, who's helped direct some of the most important research into the powerful nonlinear effects of meditation and unity consciousness and the non-dual implications of leading-edge physics. At the end of this month, I'll be bringing you James Beres, the Dharma and meditation teacher who wrote the book Awakening Joy. Okay, let's dive into some questions. What do we have here? Well, let's begin with a live question. Jody Fabricant from Highland, New York. You're live. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a brief question, and I really, really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you. My question is, I just want to know, Jean, like, what can you describe or articulate, you know, what really keeps you going on this path, what, you know, lights your fire, what, just to explain it and clarify it for us?
What lights my fire? That you're asking a personal question. I think it is, for me personally, it's something I've had all my life. It's a sense of history. It's a sense of being alive in what is, without question, the most interesting, provocative, difficult, challenging, and yet potent time in human history. I mean, other times in history thought they were it. They're wrong. This is it, you know. And really having a deep sense that what we do profoundly makes a difference as to whether we as a species are going to grow or die. So that every day, you know, before I really come into consciousness or I wake up, I what's in my mind is dear God or dear great whatever, please let me be of benefit to somebody today, you know. And so I really do look for those opportunities to be present, to be of benefit, and to share our experience. It's not just that I'm a benefit to them, but they are also, because by nature we are relational beings. They are to me, you see. Also, there's things that I do that I really love. I'm very, very much of an animal person. I always have been. In fact, one of my favorite books is one I wrote called Mystical Dogs, which is about these dogs right in front of me wagging their tails like mad because they know that I'm going to take them out as soon as this is over. And, you know, animals to me have always been tremendous beings of guidance, you know, and I find that we err greatly when we think of them as lesser than ourselves. They are other tribes. They are other nations, you know. And so I think that's important. I happen to be a very good cook. And the reason I'm such a good cook is because my mother, whose name was Maria Nunziata Serafina Graziella Fiorino Perpetuo Tedaro, born in Syracuse, Sicily, married Jack Houston of Texas. They hated each other's food. My father could not abide the smell of garlic. So in order to try to keep them together, I was not successful. I became, at 8 years old, the world's first fusion cook, you know, making chicken fried polenta. So there's certain things that I love to do, and I really try, especially when I'm home, I'm on the road a lot, you know, is to be, to do what I like and to cook, you know, to cook for the sheer delight of others as well as myself. My late husband, my husband of 43 years, died 3.5 years ago, and so I don't have quite the same kind of audience. But the whole idea of doing arts or crafts or skills or things that really give you great delight, and making sure that at least every week you do something that continues your artistic or aesthetic expression in the world. But mostly it's about the fact that we're in this thrilling time and to be a part of it.
Thank you very much for that answer. It's been a very thrilling time. And I just want to share with you the last thing is that I also was born in 7 months. And
yes.
So I definitely understand that sheath that we lack, but it also makes one very empathetic. And I also do animal rescue.
Do you? Okay. Well, we're like twins, you and I.
We're like twins, definitely. Well, thank you so much. Have a very nice night.
Thank you. You know, Terry, you know, just to expand upon that, people tell me that I'm uniquely blessed with opportunities, and yet when I examine their lives, I find that too often they're walking blind and deaf through a garden of possibilities, some of which are whistling, yoo-hoo, over here, hey, listen, here's a new friend for you, there's a new road for you to take, a fresh role for you to master, come on, pay attention. And through it all, they sleepwalk, mumbling, nothing ever happens. Only when the opportunity for a larger life lays directly across their path do they stumble into possibility. Now, I have lived, as I said in my autobiography, which is called A Mythic Life, I've lived mythically because I've caught the fleeting glimpse of opportunity from the corner of my eye and said yes to risk, and I've sought out the adventure. Of course, this pattern was primed by my acceptance of life as inherently mythic and therefore as an exploration into God, as the poet Christopher Fry put it. And I've come to believe that life is allied with myth, with the larger story, in order that we may advance along an evolutionary path that carries us nearer to the spiritual source that is always luring us into greater becoming.
Wow. You're so gorgeous, Jean. I'm going to do my job though and notice the many questions that people have typed in right
now.
Okay, please. We have several that are quite interesting. One of them is from Naomi in Cleveland, who's asking, you might say, a very basic and raw human question. How do I become more self-disciplined and stop abusing myself? It seems like an endless cycle. I keep procrastinating and not moving forward, and I abuse myself. How do I stop living in fear?
Well, you know, I'm not going to try to answer psychologically because I don't know Naomi's story, you know.
Sure.
But one of the reasons that we, and Naomi is speaking for millions of people, first of all, she's not speaking. I mean, to be human is a very drastic acceptance of a very strange role. Because for one thing, we've got three brains that don't particularly talk to each other. We have a very ancient, archaic, you know, reptilian brain, which is a survivor brain, you know, which is great for crossing the streets and getting us from here to there, but really often fools us because it does keep reviving all these fears, you know, the ancient fears of survival. Then we have the thundering herds of mammalian beasts, you know, in our limbic system, you know, which causes us to enter into all kinds of interesting relationships. And then, of course, we have this brain of this curious child, this genius child in our frontal cortex. So we are already put together in a very peculiar way that both is for extraordinary experience and transcendence, and we do trip ourselves up all the time. My answer is that we often need others. Margaret Mead on her deathbed said to me, "Jean, forget everything I've been teaching you about working with governments and bureaucracies." And I looked down in shock and I said, "Now you tell me." She says, "Yes." She said, "I'm lying here being an anthropologist on my own dying, and I've realized if we're going to survive our time and get over our fears, it's a question of people getting together in small groups of teaching learning communities and really growing together and empowering each other, not psychotherapeutic communities, because that's something different, but these are growth communities where we grow in body, mind, and spirit." And I said, "Well, how?" She said, "Well, you know, write for these people." And I said, "Okay, I will." She said, "But doing other people's kind of work so that as you're growing," she used the term, "cooking on more burners, then the things that are always defeating you will be only a shadow in the corner of your reality and not take up so much of your reality," you know, as we talked about this. So I think one of the important things is to find teaching, learning communities in which you grow together. And then as a result of that growth, you go out and you begin to do things. I mean, to better the community, to better the local your local community and family and whatever it is. But
and even to take care of yourself, perhaps, as she's talking about abusing herself, there is something in that, finding a community of support and practice that can share your healthy intentions.
Share your healthy intentions and find out what your healthy intentions are and really spend time with them. Another thing is, you know, in these kinds of situations, as you have shown so often in your work on integral practice, exercise is critical. Because a lot of depression and self-hatred comes out of the fact that your body, frankly, and I mean your body and your hormones and everything, gets stuck in same old, same old. And if you start to move your body, I'm not talking about running, you know, a mile a day, I'm talking, or 5 miles a day, what some people do. I'm talking about exercise that is regular, that gets the blood going, that gets the chemistry to move toward the chemistry of health. It also means to begin to hold an optimal image, an optimal template. I mean, these are some of the things, as you know, Terry, that I teach in that 7-week course. So I hope Naomi will join us as she has joined you in that 7-week course, Awakening. I go to, what is it called? Awakening Your Purpose Course, I think it's called.
Awaken Your Purpose Course.
AwakenYourPurposeCourse.com. Because it's the kind of thing that is not only in terms of the 7 weeks of showing you ways of simply using much more of yourself and getting beyond these negative habits, but also in addition to that, I do a regular each week a question and answer live and help you with very 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 particular issues like that. So get
beautiful.
Moving, Naomi. Get moving physically. Get moving, come into these courses, or find your own teaching learning community or create it out of good folks, not people with similar problems. And not that they're not good folks, but you want to have people who can be there as a support community to you.
Beautiful. Now, here's, I think, a very alive and authentic question from my friend Kay Burrows in Blaine, Washington. She says, "The two of you make this journey more understandable for me, but I feel very impatient with my journey because I started later in my life, and though much transformation is taking place, I don't sense I will make a great contribution in this time of Earth's crisis and human crisis. Some of the sentences you speak take months to years to become realized. Right now I feel called to a very simple, contemplative, deeply spiritual, creative life, immersed in and connected with nature. Could this be enough in my lifetime?"
Absolutely enough. You're one of those that keeps the earth going by your sheer appreciation of its beauty. I mean, God is in the details. Because I happen to live a large public life doesn't mean, I assure you, Kate, that my life is more important than yours. I'm just one of these people who runs around, but you are the one who really is grounded in the depths of human experience, in your relationship to nature, in your support and caring for and appreciation for the moment. This is the basis of the very architecture of the world that sustains the nature of reality. What you're doing is as important, if not a great deal more important, than the kinds of people the kinds of things that people like me do. It's just that we live in a world, in America, that is really stupid in that it extols celebrities and seeming large accomplishments. There's no such thing as large or small accomplishments. There is the presence to the witness of being there for reality, wherever and however and with whomever it is found.
Beautiful. Beautifully put, too. Here's an interesting question from my friend Jillian Ross in Nimbin, Australia, near, I think that's near Byron Bay. She says, I would love to hear what the term soul means to Jean, and in particular, if she can say something about how it might relate to Mark Gaffney's teachings on the unique self. Is the soul's journey one of becoming or awakening to our unique self, or is it perhaps something different?
Well, I would have to say it's both and plus much, much more. Soul is that one of like the one of those words like love or schizophrenia that really kind of encompasses a great galaxy of interpretations. It is, if I were to say it is the force majeure, if I were to say it is the life force of being in nature, if I were to say it is the God stuff essence that is incarnate in our local space-time vehicle, I mean, all of these would be true and not true, or rather, they'd be true but not accurate, as opposed to being accurate but not true. But to me, soul is essence. It is also what I use the ancient Greek word entelechy. It's the entelechy of an acorn to be an oak tree. It's the entelechy of a seed to be a fruit or flower. It is the entelechy of a baby to be a grown-up human being. It is the entelechy of you and me to be that which is the larger substance and becoming of our existence. Soul is, I think, that if I said God's spark, I think it's much more than spark. I think it's the whole conflagration. I mean, we are the universe in miniature. And I think that universe in miniature has the essence of the life process, the life existence itself that is yearning at the threshold of your mind to come into space and time. Sometimes it erupts in a whole society like it did, for example, during the Renaissance. Sometimes it banks low. But wherever it is that excitation of that God stuff that really yearns to have its deep expression through you in many, many ways.
That's beautiful. And as I'm contemplating all of that call and how you're suggesting we manifest it, I'm reminded of the story you told about Margaret Mead. And there are two things about that I find particularly provocative. One of them is that it resonates so much with this very famous quote that's probably the thing most of us hear from her most.
Never doubt.
Yes. Never doubt that
a small group of thoughtful,
you go ahead,
committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has.
Right. And her admonition to you had to do with gathering together with small groups of committed people.
Go out and do it, Jean.
Yeah. So that
create teaching learning communities. Where
that's a very powerful admonition to us. It's kind of like look each other in the eye and get real about your responsibility as citizens in this community, this world, this noosphere, this planet. And yet this arrived not from her being immersed in the activity of life, but her standing on the threshold in which she was about to let go.
She was about
completely
to cross over into the great adventure, yes. Yeah.
And so how interesting that from that vantage point
she died the next day.
She died the very next day.
Well,
after
it was either the next
that
day or 2 days, but she died, within a day or two afterwards.
Right. How does that, that feels very poignant and kind of,
yes, it was.
Quite, that right there on that edge she would be saying, don't work with the governments, just work, just get down there with
no,
get down there with groups of people in a deep and powerful
that's
way.
That's right. She saw it. She saw life very, very different, very differently. She saw, this is 1978, November of 1978. And she had this vision. It was like the veil between the present and the future was torn apart. And she saw a great deal. She didn't really go into detail with me, but she saw the world as it was going to change very, very radically. But she also said in her own gruff, she says, "Oh, I'm so mad about this dying business because I would know how to guide it." Change. She was very angry about leaving at that time.
Because
she was always so immersed in life. You know?
Yeah.
Are there more questions?
There are several. Yeah. In fact, there's one live question that I'd like to respond to. This is someone in Acton, Massachusetts, 978 area code. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Terry and Gene. This is Joe Caratinudo.
Yes, hi, Joe.
Hi. My question is on the myth of the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. And my impression, especially through all the evolutionary stuff I've been looking at, is that the archetypes themselves seem to be evolving.
Yes.
And in your own seminar that I saw come across my email a couple days ago about going into almost a non-local time and using allies to help us learn something quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what you called it. But it seems to me that we don't necessarily have to go through the whole journey anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes almost instantaneously we can get to where we need to go. Do you see something like that? That almost things are becoming different in a way now than they've ever been before, and even the old myths that have been tried and true for so long are not necessarily holding sway anymore.
Mm-hmm. I think the journey has many, many more passages than, and the passages are not necessarily sequential. Also, with women rising slowly but surely to full partnership with men, a woman's journey does have some differences than the men's journey, because with women the emphasis is more on process rather than product, on making things cohere and grow and develop. So that you have the very fact of the women's journey. You have the journey of people of all ages. You have the fact of all these kids with their transcendental thumbs making connections, sometimes 5,000 a day in the Facebooks, etc. The world has added so much more complexity that we would have to say the journey itself is shifting. Now, but to answer the question is, do we all have to go through all those stages? I think it is part of the nature of the life process itself that we are given those stages, whether we like it or not. For example, in the beginning of our call, Terry wisely spoke about how during the course of an hour, didn't you say, Terry, that you might actually be going through various aspects of that journey.
Yes.
In the course of it may be in a feeling state rather than an outward adventure state, but in a feeling state you might go through the period of the sense of loss, the sense of being found, the sense of the call, the sense of having to get past the guardian of the threshold, the sense of being in the belly of the whale.
I see, yeah. So faster, but not necessarily skipping steps.
Yeah. So it may be and sometimes one will stay in one stage with a great luminosity. But I think also the other thing that you spoke about the fact that the archetypes themselves are always growing. And the great myths tend to be interpreted in one way for one era and in another way for another. For example, an archetype that I am particularly fond of, the goddess Athena, Minerva in the Latin, and she takes on different forms like Saraswati in India, who is a wisdom figure but also a goddess of civilization, of making civilizations work. That's something that we find that she is no longer the roaring war goddess that you find in earlier strata of the myth, her mythic form, but she certainly still is the protector of civilizations, of cultures, but she's also the one who is an evocateur of art, of literature, of wisdom in terms of our time and also of civilization as we move toward what I believe is a coming world civilization with high, high individuation of culture. So these archetypes are grown. For example, in the Odyssey, Hermes is no longer the thief and the trickster. Athena is not the warring war goddess, but in the Odyssey, so different from the Iliad, the Odyssey, she becomes one who is ever near those who would make a difference, those who would turn the page on possibility as she becomes the great evocateur of Odysseus, you see. So I think in the same way, when we look at those old archetypes, they are shifting, they're very fluid, they're flexible. They're not incarnated in space-time suits like we are, so they have a greater flexibility. And as we tune into them, we often find the ones that have the greatest responsiveness to our own situation, and then we find ourselves to be accompanied by this higher essence, this deeper this deeper friend of potency.
Thank you.
Beautiful, Jean. Thanks so much, Joe. Good to hear your voice. Okay, well, we're getting kind of close to our end here, but I want to sneak in at least one more question to you, Jean.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one that's really quite different. Melanie from Quebec asks, I think, a very deceptively simple but kind of profound question. Is there really any such thing as missing the mark, missing the boat? Or is it all perfect as it is all the time, depression and all?
Well, if I'm right in my own personal myth that I put out earlier, that this is God's school, you know, this is the place where we have all the challenges. Maybe some other planets are planets of sweetness and of taste and of eating or of, you know, or of music, but this is the God school where we are perhaps being prepared for an even larger journey. Maybe it's to help other planets or other places or dimensions to grow, and thus we're given a full accompaniment of challenges and of difficulties and of opportunities. So I don't know about missing the mark, but I think it is the fact that it may be that we even choose, as the ancients felt and as the people's many Asian philosophies believe, maybe we actually choose what is called the paradigma in Plato. Maybe we choose the lot of our life as a very rich learning experience. So in terms of perfection, I don't know. But in terms of learning, this being the opportunity to learn and to confront and to evoke and to be part of this glorious ebullient life process that gives us so many different experiences, I would say it's not about the mark, it's about the adventure. It is about that we are soul crafters, we are being midwifed into experiences that give us the fullness and ultimately the fulfillment of the life process itself.
Mm. That's gorgeous. You know, something occurs to me to add in, Jean, if you don't mind, that I would want to answer that question, everything is perfect exactly as it is, and that there, in a profound and very real sense, there is no missing of the mark. Mm-hmm. And if we don't treat each moment as having opportunities that give what's best in us a chance for expression, and therefore at least treat the moment as if something is really at stake, and that there is a hitting of the mark and a missing of the mark, a rising to the moment or a failure to rise to the moment. If we don't feel that we're being called for our best and that something is at stake in that process, we can't really engage and play with our fullest.
Yes.
But once something has happened and we seemingly have made a mistake or seemingly have missed the mark, the important perspective to take is the one in which we recognize that in some sense there really is no missing of the mark. Whatever has already happened, whatever water is already under the bridge, it really is part of the perfection. But and so that kind of quality of regret or you know, crying over spilt milk is never appropriate. But in this next moment, there is some opportunity to see that deeper rightness or not, to make gestures in consciousness. And so holding both sides of that paradox maybe can help us to neither throw out the relative nor the absolute, and to be active and engaged citizens of this paradoxical human condition.
Paradoxical human, yes. You know, it reminds me, perhaps as part of our closing here, of the great poem by Christopher Fry, who really speaks of this, and when he says that the human heart can go to the length of God. Dark and cold we may be, but this is no winter now. The frozen misery of centuries cracks, breaks, begins to move. The thunder is the thunder of the flood, the flow, the upstart spring. And then he says, thank God, our time is now, when wrong comes up to meet us everywhere, never to leave us, till we take the longest stride of soul men ever took. Affairs are now soul-sized. The enterprise is exploration into God. What are you making for? It takes so many thousand years to wake. But will you wake, for pity's sake?
Oh, that's gorgeous. Thank you. Just a few things here at the end. If you value what you're receiving here, thank you so much, Jean. That was so gorgeous.
Thank you.
Please support our work by letting others know about it, and they can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you'd like to drink deeper and work with Jean and hear more and really engage her personally, please head to awakenyourpurposecourse.com. You're invited to go to integralspiritualpractice.com to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter, and there you'll find details about my upcoming teaching events, including the one in New York at the beginning of March and the five-day seminar I'll be leading in British Columbia, Canada at Hollyhock Farm from June 10th to 15th. And now some detail about what's coming here on Beyond Awakening.
I'll also say if people want to be on my mailing list, they can go to genehouston.org, and there's a sign up for getting a newsletter, and that way you get on the mailing list about all our other programs.
Genehouston.org.
Yeah.
Good.
Houston's
okay.
In Texas.
I'm glad. Yes.
Thank you.
I did mention this coming Sunday, February 12th, I'll be talking with physicist and large-scale spiritual activist John Hagelin on Only Higher Consciousness Can Transform Our World. February 26th, I'll be talking with the wonderful Buddhist teacher James Beres, author of Awakening Joy. In March, I'll be talking with poet and sacred activist Drew Dellinger, the remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher Thomas Hubel, and the brilliant Peter Baumann, formerly of Tangerine Dream and now author of the remarkable new volume Ego, the Book. So thank you so much for joining Jean and me today. Let's open up the phone lines. We can't open up the computer lines so that many of us can hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye. Goodbye, and thank
bye.
You. Thank
I heard
you.
A goodbye. Goodbye. Goodbye, too.
Okay. So long, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
All right.